Today in Studio 360, a starving writer takes a job at a hedge fund.
I got to Midtown Manhattan and I thought, oh my goodness, you know, money makes the world go round, right?
And finds a subject worthy of poetry.
It was like magic. How are they just making more and more of this money?
Katie Lederer, a former finance executive, tells us what modern money making and modern verse have in common. And a little later, we'll send one of our producers on an eerie mission.
So we're going into the forest, which is really quite dark.
A journey to the heart of a Japanese forest with a very dark reputation.
They came to Aokigahara Jukai trying to commit suicide.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and that is all ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Money is on everybody's mind right now. Having it, not having it, maybe not going to get it anytime soon. The financial system imploded because we were all crazily borrowing and investing and spending on faith. And now we're trying to keep it afloat by desperately borrowing and investing and spending on more faith, new faith. It's almost poetic. And that's where Katie Lederer comes in. Lederer had an MFA in poetry and was living a life of artistic poverty in New York City. Way behind on her credit card payments, she eventually lost her apartment. She moved in with her brother out in Las Vegas. He is a champion professional poker player, Howard Lederer. That's when Katie had a change of heart.
I thought, well, I want money right now. I want money and benefits. Where can I get those things? So I thought, hedge fund. They make money at hedge funds.
This is going back a few years. Hedge funds were absolutely booming. Lederer got a job at a fund in New York near Times Square that had $3 billion under management.
I got to Midtown Manhattan and I thought, oh my goodness, you know, money makes the world go round, right? And I wasn't seeing this mechanism before. I didn't understand it. I never read the business section. I couldn't read the Wall Street Journal to save my life. So it was like magic. It was like, how are they just making more and more of this money? I actually took the Series 7, which is a stockbroker's license, a hideous, horrible test. It's a six-hour test. It's an 800-page, very dry study book. Learned about what a stock is, learned about what a bond is. I didn't know what those things were.
Lederer eventually learned enough to become a top executive at the fund, but she still found time to write poetry. And a lot of the poems in her recent book are about money and our complicated lust for it. It's called The Heaven-Sent Leaf.
It was actually, I was pretty uncomfortable writing about money. It's not considered a particularly couth topic for poetry.
The sort of writerly culture, the bien pensant, thinks, ooh, business, ooh, money, ew.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think they also think, oh, topics, subject matter.
Yes.
People are much more interested in form, line, texture. People aren't talking a lot about content.
Whereas, quite to the contrary, in one of your poems, I have to say I was shocked to encounter the name Mike Milken, the 80s financier,
yeah,
in a serious poem. I mean, well, that isn't what you expect when you read serious poetry.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I keep thinking about that sort of aphorism, there's nothing new under the sun, there's nothing new under the sun. And sometimes I think, especially, you know, working at a hedge fund, for example, I'm like, this is quite new, if you ask me.
Would you read your poem, The Tender Wish to Buy This World?
Sure. And I'll actually quickly preface this poem by saying that I wrote it right after 9/11. And it struck me at the time that everyone went on antidepressants at the same time. The tender wish to buy this world, the shedding of leaves from the wallet of mourning. Down low by the bridge in the city of money, I will take up this axe, shatter gently this greed. We are thinking of our heartfelt need, our man, his brain dreaming atop the clean pillow. In the wallet of his soul, he files the crisp new bills of mourning. This old depression, when the world will stretch a field of deep ravines. Oh, pale pill, oh, obsequious friend to the needy and next, to the novitiates who play this miss and sen. Oh, smotherer, oh, plowshare, oh, savior and deranger of the senses.
That was Katie Lederer reading her poem, The Tender Wish to Buy This World. What was interesting to me about that poem, as you say, written right after 9/11, is that this was in the financial capital of the world that this attack took place. And you were right there, sort of mingling in the money wallet metaphors, even in the immediate aftermath.
Yes. I think it was interesting when 9/11 took place, there was a lot of hysteria and people were pretty convinced that the next thing they would do is try to blow up the financial system. And I think it's quite ironic, you know, in a macabre sense, that we sort of did it ourselves. You know, I didn't realize there was like a Madoff Ponzi scheme going on, sort of whatever, around the corner somewhere. But, you know, working in Midtown Manhattan, I was like, this is so clean. It's so beautiful. It's amazing. It's these amazing, brilliant math PhDs coming up with these gorgeous, you know, models, brilliant, brilliant models. But somewhere down there, somewhere in those numbers, down the line, you know, there are real people, real objects, maybe not so real.
It also strikes me, here you were in charge of hiring these brilliant math PhDs to deal with these increasingly, incredibly abstract financial derivatives and products. It strikes me as impossible to understand and abstract as, you know, John Ashbery's poetry.
Yes. It's mind-blowing, sort of all the different inputs and all the different priors and all the different algorithms they're developing, and the fact that they're basically almost like skimming money off of the surface of the economy, right? They kind of take this model and they're kind of collecting nickels and collecting pennies. It's like sometimes you'll see movies where someone comes up with a scheme to steal millions of dollars by transferring half of a penny from everyone's bank account in the entire world.
It's pretty brilliant. What it does is every time there's a bank transaction where interest is computed, you know, thousands a day, the computer ends up with these fractions of a cent, which it usually rounds off. But what this does is it takes those little remainders and puts it into an account.
This sounds familiar.
Yeah, they did in Superman 3.
Right.
And it adds up. It adds up to billions of dollars. And I think poetry has taken that direction also. You see people doing these chance operation poems. They'll say, I'm going to write a 100-page poem without using, you know, the letter E. In a way, my book is an algorithm, even though it's more traditional. I'm going to write some poems about money. They're all 13 lines. That's an algorithm. Ironically enough, you know, in finance, I can't really talk a lot about my former employer, right? I sort of signed some things when I started working there. I signed some things when I left. But I can write poetry about my experience there without getting sued. So
The new exit contracts that people are going to be required to sign will now include poetry.
Absolutely. You know, my boss actually at the hedge fund had been studying to get a PhD from Columbia. He was studying William Blake, and he was studying, he was studying the death instinct, I think, in William Blake.
That's you can't make that up.
No, it's very funny. And he was my boss. It was kind of funny. He had been at the hedge fund for, I think, probably almost 20 years.
There's something sort of hilarious about you, the poet, these abstract quantitative math wizards and a former Blake scholar all running billions of dollars of the American financial system. I think there's a sitcom there.
Yes.
Katie, what's the name of the poem in which you mentioned Mike Milken?
Intimacy.
Could you read that?
Sure. Intimacy. These three bridges, like the brain, lit up and heading out toward Brooklyn. I'm slumped in the cab, thinking heady thoughts of heady things, like an ostrich, or like an intellectual thriller. For example, Den of Thieves, in which the arbitrageur Michael Milken is at first defined by a healthy ambition that later in the story turns to plot-driving greed. It's as if his most natural desire to do good had over many years metastasized, crackling over the phone lines, hiding out in the back seat of his de rigueur black limousine via messenger across the park, his pulmonary conscience pumping darkly in his greedy heart. Like a toddler hiding grimly in a closet or hamper, or like the king who fled the palace on the hill that's now ablaze, which explains, I guess, the fighter jets that circle overhead, the surfeit of broadband, as well as this beautiful bed, now bereft of our lowly ambition. I'm lying here. There's no one else. And the flowers that you've given me are wilting in the slurpy cup. There is ambient noise, noise of jet planes, desire.
That is Katie Lederer reading her poem, Intimacy. And now that you're back to being a poet again and out of the financial world, do you feel as though you'll ever go back there or some other version of the real world to earn a living?
So I left my job last August, and I've basically been living on some savings. But I got a call out of the blue from a university, a woman who runs their poetry program, and she said, we'd really love you to come teach. We have a two-year visiting writer appointment. It's an endowed, named appointment. What do you think? Great. Sounds great. I get to go teach poetry, and it wasn't a huge course load. I'd get benefits, and great. She calls me a week later and says, ugh, I'm so embarrassed. We have to pull this. And basically, this university was very invested in Madoff. So the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away.
Or what goes around comes around. But that is the perhaps the greatest, richest irony of this current moment that I've heard. So something else will come along that wasn't wiped out by Madoff. At least the world's out there recognizing that they want you.
The world is going to be wiped out by Madoff.
Katie Lederer, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Katie Lederer's book of poems is called The Heaven-Sent Leaf, and she's also the author of the memoir, Poker Face. Do any of you have any poetic thoughts about the current financial crisis? Since we're in tough economic times, let's keep it economical. We want your best haiku. Go to studio360.org to post your poem, and we'll read our favorites on the air in the weeks to come. And speaking of communicating in a Japanese form, the key to a happy marriage? Never learn your spouse's language.
So we still speak in sort of four-year-old pidgin English 21 years on.
The writer Pico Iyer on his life in Japan.
I find I can communicate much better with her than with many of my friends back in California.
And I would think bickering is impossible if you really don't speak the language, right?
Beautifully said.
That's coming up in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International, and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. That is a Buddhist monk blowing into this gigantic seashell.
This is an instrument for purify the ground and celebrate God's or nature's universe.
He was blowing his seashell in Yoyogi Park in the middle of Tokyo. Studio 360 was just there, and we were running all around for weeks, talking to artists, writers, cutting-edge designers, and eating weird stuff while people chain-smoked around us. We'll have a lot more to tell you about our trip on next week's show, but one of my first stops was to visit an old friend. Pico Iyer is a travel writer, maybe the foremost travel writer in the world right now, as well as a novelist. Pico lives near the town of Nara, an ancient place. It was the capital of Japan back in the 8th century. He took me to this beautiful park filled with 1,200 insanely tame deer. Mating deer. They roam free.
And they pretty much rule the place. They're associated with a shrine here, and they're regarded as sacred messengers, emissaries from the gods, actual living treasures. So if you and I were to hit a deer inadvertently as we walked away from here, we'd be liable to imprisonment, actually. They're the most protected beings in Nara.
I was careful not to hit a deer. P. Pico Iyer has been in Japan for most of the last two decades. He came, like a lot of Westerners, to study Buddhism. He was going to live in a monastery for a year.
And of course, my year lasted a week, because as soon as I got here, I found that a week or a year in a monastery was not sitting contemplating the full moon and writing depthless haiku and all the aesthetic beauties that I'd imagined in Santa Barbara. It was scrubbing the floors and raking the leaves and incredibly hard work of the kind that I'd already done much too much of in English boarding school. And also I found, as soon as I arrived in Zen Temple in Japan, it was filled with people from Santa Cruz, Boston, and Berkeley. So I told myself, and I think there's some truth to it, that I could learn more about that Buddhism just by walking down the streets and going into the convenience stores and department stores and McDonald's and seeing not really so much the forms that had so bewitched me in poems and woodcuts, but the values that underlie the forms. For example, if you're in a McDonald's, you'll notice how a mother almost silently will impart to her five-year-old son how to give his food to his little sister, or how to think about the harmony of the whole much more than getting the French fries that he wants. And at every level, you're seeing this invisible training in attentiveness, which I think is really what makes the whole society function still.
But instead of simply going back to Santa Barbara after a week, you have remained here most of your time. Why are you here?
It's a wonderful place to write. Extremely quiet. Everything works. It's a wonderful mix, I find, of energy and tranquility. There's always a sense everyone around me in the streets is going somewhere, doing something. It's very, very directed, and yet they're infallibly silent while they're doing it.
So Japan is kind of a McDowell colony for you permanently. It's a place where you can work.
Exactly so. And the thing that's really preserved my sanity here is I've never had to be a grown-up here. I've never done one day of work within Japanese society. Happily, I'm just able to be a foreigner with diplomatic immunity, as it were, walking through the surfaces of this endlessly fascinating and changing society, looking through the windows, but never actually having to be in the thick of the conversation, which is not what everybody would choose. But the great foreign expat in Japan, Donald Ritchie, an American writer who's been here since 1946, always says, coming to Japan, he gave up a sense of belonging for a sense of freedom. And so I suppose that's the trade I've made. I've never really wanted to be a part of a community. So this is ideal because I'm always apart from it.
What do you find to be the uniquely Japanese aspects of Japan?
Silence, attention, selflessness. And it took me a long time after I got to Japan to learn to stop my mouth, to attend to what was going on around me, to notice what kind of tea the woman on the other side of the table was drinking. All those quiet things that seem kind of obsolete or old-fashioned in 21st century Japan, but I think really make up the fabric and the backbone of the country and what keeps it so distinctive. I mean, as you said, I've been here 20 years now, and it feels ever more like another planet to me, and in a completely confounding way. I mean, it's almost like a 2,000-year-old person wearing a microskirt and artificial tan and carrying a surfboard. And I think when we respond to Japanese artists, whether it's Haruki Murakami, the writer, or Issey Miyake, or even Nobu, the chef, what all of them are doing is in some ways packaging something very old in a very sleek, cool, new form.
How much Japanese do you speak now?
Very, very little. And I can come up with all forms of ways of justifying it to myself. But really, I gave up before I began.
But and really, how much can you speak? I mean, can you say, where's the train station?
Yes, I can do that. Enough to get around, but not to have a conversation, which suits the Japanese perfectly, because they're very happy not to have a conversation with me. And I think my part in the formalized pageantry of Japanese society is to be the scruffy beast in the margins who never begins to intrude on the society. Even though I've lived here 20 years, it used to be that every time I flew into Osaka Airport, 3-4 times a year, they would always strip search me at the airport. As soon as they saw me, the panic signals
even
would go off.
Even before they thought you were a terrorist? This is long before 9/11?
Long before 9/11, but even then, partly because of their distance from the world, they thought either I was an illegal immigrant from Iran, which I could look like with my Indian complexion, or I was Saddam Hussein's brother, or most of all, just that I was a wild card. I didn't fit into the equation of Japanese society. And the way the society functions here is really, I think, like an orchestra. Everyone is playing from the same score. Each has his or her own instrument, but the intent always is larger harmony. And in an orchestra, let's say you've got the New York Symphony playing Beethoven, if suddenly someone from Iran runs onto the stage, he is only going to be a disruptive element. And so from a Japanese point of view, I can entirely understand why they are so unsettled by people like me. And the only way that we can be placed inside the society is as sort of token sources of tragicomedy and figures of fun.
Perhaps you would still be here simply having come here and found all of its sublime peace that it gives you and the ability to work and the pleasant outsider feeling it gives you. You also met and fell in love with a Japanese person whom you've written about.
And who, in the archetypal way of things, only dreams of California. But you're absolutely right. When I, my third week in Japan, 21 years ago, I met the woman who's now my wife. And what struck me then, and I think it's still the case, is that Japan is really doing the splits. Because what all of us notice, wherever we are, is that Japanese women are the ones traveling abroad, learning English, acquiring foreign partners, joining foreign companies, and staking out futures and destinies and possibilities in a foreign context that they could never have in rather stuck, fixed, traditional Japan. Whereas Japanese men, because the system favors them, are very much rooted in the way things have always been.
So here you were, newly in Japan. How did you meet?
Well, auspiciously enough, at a temple, at an initiation ceremony where a Roshi, a high abbot of a Zen temple, a high master, was moving to some even higher degree of enlightenment or elevation or whatever. And so we just happened to be sitting next to one another at lunch. And I suppose what each of us quickly sensed, I quickly realized that she was just crying to break out of the role into which she'd been imprisoned, really, for all her 30 years. At that point, she'd never been on a plane. She'd never really been outside her hometown of Kyoto. And she had this vast hunger. So, of course, we were each reaching past one another because I was desperate to question her on 8th century Japanese poems and the like. But what's really startled me was that in the course of my year, which had meant to be 1 year sitting stilly in a Zen temple, that actually became the year of watching her transform her life as quickly and dramatically and efficiently as Japan itself had transformed its life in the wake of the war. Almost the day Japan lost to America, it said, well, we're going to embrace the American system and do it better than America. And within a year, as if they just flipped a switch, they were doing it. So with Hiroko, having within the course of that year finished her qualifications to become a tour guide and starting to lead even more bewildered Japanese around the rest of the world.
So when you met 20 years ago, you spoke the same primitive Japanese that you speak today. She spoke very little English as well. We've established that your Japanese hasn't improved much. How about her English?
I wouldn't say it's improved at all either, but we're each so bad at the other's language, we haven't been able to instruct the other. So we still speak in sort of four-year-old pidgin English, 21 years on. And I must say, I find I can communicate much better with her than with many of my friends back in California, where I'm babbling and babbling like this, but probably, you know, off on my own planet, just thinking about how to make a nice sentence or how to say something cool that will stay with them and not actually thinking about communication. Whereas with her, I have to use words that she'll understand, and I'm really anxious to get the meaning across, like a present I would be handing from myself over to her, and she conversely. And in some ways, what I suppose she's been instructing me in is how to speak without language as I know it. And how to navigate or negotiate almost any situation without needing to use excess words. And it struck me at some point that I don't need four-syllable words or technical terms from the study of English literature to work out the destiny of my stepchildren or my step-parents. And so it's actually been very liberating for me to come to Japan, and especially through this unusual relationship, to see how much I can dispense with. And I've learnt Japanese well enough in that sense to say, you talk only to offer something to somebody else, not to display yourself.
And I would think with a wife, it would just reduce whole vast realms of possibility of bickering. Bickering is impossible if you really don't speak the language, right?
Beautifully said. I can't wound her with words. And I think this permeates everything in Japan's relations with the world as well as with one another. People learn always to avoid confrontation and by not saying anything to step past what in our context or society might quickly become a head-on collision. And again, it's been an instruction to me in the art of human relations, which I think Japan has mastered.
This is a pleasure, Pico. Thank you very much for coming out here and explaining Japan to us.
Thanks. This is really fun for me. This is the social highlight of my fall, so thank you.
You can see a video of Pico and me at that beautiful park in Nara at studio360.org. Pico described Japan as a 2,000-year-old person in a miniskirt. And it's true. Walking around Tokyo, you see the miniskirt part. People are totally attached to their cell phones. They work 10 to 12-hour days standard. The information overload is like nothing I've ever seen. And it seems like the Japanese can't get enough of Starbucks. But wait a second. Isn't this the land of tea? Women in kimono, seated quietly on tatami mats, contemplating Zen poetry? Or does that Japan even exist anymore? We sent Studio 360's Jenny Lawton to find out.
To learn the ritual art of serving tea, or chado, I head out to a little farmhouse tucked in the hills outside of Kyoto.
So now it's time to take off your shoes. Yeah, here.
No, take up here.
Note to self, take shoes off before entering tea room.
How did I know I was going to screw up in the first 30 seconds? Okay.
Okay, and...
If you want to, you can sit down and slip them off and then step up.
That's Richard and Mari Milgram. Richard, an American, is a master of Japanese tea ceramics. And Mari has been teaching tea presentation for 30 years. She's got lovely, long gray hair. And, lucky for me, she laughs easily.
I was going to put on kimono, but I didn't.
That's fine.
I was running around this morning, so. Running around the house, of course.
Stepping inside the tea room is like going 400 years back in time. The walls are lined with tatami mats and paper screens. I sit next to a sunken hearth, where a kettle is already steaming. When Mari enters the room, she has a tray full of bowls and containers. She shuffles over to me, kneels, and then Mari makes me tea, step by step. She places the utensils on the tatami mat in front of her. She pulls out a small cloth and folds it precisely. She wipes a container holding green tea powder. She wipes the tea scoop. She wipes the tea bowl. She examines the whisk. She wipes the water container. She picks up the water ladle. She lifts the water container lid. She ladles hot water from the kettle into the tea bowl. She lifts up the whisk, places it in the tea bowl, then examines it again.
If you do presentation, you create the space, you create the time, you create the atmosphere, like together. So guest and the host becomes one.
She picks up the tea scoop. She picks up the tea container. She removes the lid. She scoops tea powder into the bowl. She replaces the lid. She ladles hot water from the water container into the kettle. She ladles water from the kettle into the tea bowl. She balances the ladle on the kettle and lets the handle fall into place. She whisks the tea. All in all, there are some 200 steps to make a bowl of tea. And that's before anyone even takes a sip.
Like this. Mm-hmm. Otemae.
Otemae.
Chodai.
Chodai.
Itashimasu.
Itashimasu.
Tea forces you to slow way down. But if you can get yourself to relax, you start to notice things. The texture of the floor, the shadows, and that the coals under the kettle make the coolest sound.
We call that matsukaze no oto.
Matsukaze no oto.
The sound of the pine trees in the wind, they make sounds. Mm-hmm. For a long time, I haven't done this at home, actually. This was my classroom, but haven't taught tea here for 8 years.
Tea rooms like Mari's are kind of an anomaly. Modern homes don't even have them. And mothers no longer teach their daughters how to make tea, and they no longer teach their daughters how to make tea. And something else, maybe even more fundamental, is missing.
I have all the utensils, all the tools here, but I couldn't put them together somehow. My mind is not here.
That's how it is all over Japan. The pace of life is swallowing up its traditions. Many people aren't doing tea because it's just too uncomfortable to turn off their cell phones and slow down long enough to do it properly. Maybe modern times can do without the formality and the rigidity of the tea ceremony. But with it go the simplicity, the sense of boundaries, the silence. Actually, the way of tea has been changing since the 1940s.
まあ、お茶ですね。ですから私よく言うんですよ。
What I often say is, my blood is not red, but green. Tea green.
お茶の湯はグリーンティー、グリーンですから。
Dr. Genshitsu Sen is the 15th generation grandmaster of the Urasenke tea tradition. As a young man, during the Second World War, he trained to be a kamikaze pilot. But he was considered too valuable to Japan to be allowed to die. Instead, he served his friends their last cup of tea before going on their suicide missions. He doesn't like to talk about it. But he will tell you that the tea he served a year later was even more important.
U.S. soldiers came here to learn tea. Their headquarters had sent them to learn the culture of the defeated country. Tea, flower arrangement, temples, shrines.
And he taught them.
The U.S. soldiers were sitting on the tatami, awkwardly on their knees, holding the cups, smelling the tea and such. It was a first for them. They were saying,
oh, terrible. What is this?
This is terrible. What is it? And I think that's fine. That's a good starting point. We were exactly the same when we were children.
As a young tea master, Sen did something radical. He dedicated himself to serving tea to foreigners. Sen is 85 years old now, a retired grandmaster, or daisosho. But he continues to serve tea around the world. He's even a UN Goodwill Ambassador, and one of his missions is to serve tea in conflict zones.
I went to Zaire. It was hard. I travel around the world, and what I think in those places is that those people cannot think of anything but themselves. I understand that. But tea works to calm them down. It makes people's mind quiet.
Now Sen has tea centers all over the world, and his headquarters in Kyoto has a special course for foreigners who live at the school for a year and learn tea in English.
In the tradition of tea, for myself, I can see the outlines for a new way of life.
Carmen Johnson is one of those students, a redhead in a dark blue kimono. She's a web developer from Dallas.
Daisosho talks about peace through a bowl of tea. It's true. I mean, I'm from Texas, and I think if any place needs more peace through a bowl of tea, it's Texas, and I want to help to spread that.
But what about the future of Japanese tea inside Japan, the world's most plugged-in, technology-crazed, fast-paced society, which probably needs chado the most?
My name is Yoko Nakayama. I'm a research assistant at the Capital Group, a mutual fund company. When chado started, it was for the samurai warriors, and their daily life is fighting. So for them, it was very relaxing to leave their swords outside of the tea room and enjoy the quiet talk. So I think it can be adapted to life now, too. Yeah.
So your sword is like your BlackBerry or your cell phone?
Probably, yeah.
But there's more going on here. See, many Japanese deal with the blinding pace of their professional or public lives by pouring their passions into a hobby, sometimes obsessively. You've probably heard of kids who geek out over anime and manga. They're called otaku.
On the weekdays, I work in Tokyo, and on weekend, on Saturdays, I go to my tea teacher's house in Kamakura, very quiet place, in kimono. I wear kimono for every lesson.
Yoko is kind of a tea otaku.
You can become a different person when you're doing it. I even feel like there are two different of me, two different person inside of me, because that they are totally different.
And that's how the way of tea survives. It isn't a common way of life as it was 50 years ago. Instead, tea is a way to resist what Japanese life has become. So the more Japan strays from the way of tea, the more passionately its followers believe.
It's treated as the same thing as learning hula, yoga, or cooking, but I feel like it's more of like learning about life. Bigger.
For Studio 360, I'm Jenny Lawton.
Coming up...
So we're going... off the road now.
We send one of our producers to an ancient forest with a very dark reputation.
Should make sure we can find our way back out again.
Yeah. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International, and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. I was in Japan recently with Studio 360's production team, and we spent a lot of our time in Tokyo. Incredibly dense and bustling and modern. It's hard to imagine anything old in Tokyo. But from a few stories up, you can see Mount Fuji. More than any one building, Mount Fuji is Tokyo's ancient landmark. At the foot of the mountain, right in its shadow, is a forest, vast and gorgeous. But it has the unhappy distinction of being the second most popular suicide spot in the world, right after the Golden Gate Bridge. The forest is called Aokigahara, or sometimes Jukai, which means Sea of Trees. Hundreds and hundreds of people have taken their lives here. Some say that the Sea of Trees got its dark reputation from a novel by Saicho Matsumoto. The novel is about Yoriko, a beautiful young woman unhappily married to a crook. She falls in love with another man who happens to be the prosecutor leading the case against her husband. Things get too complicated, so she decides to end her life. And she heads for Jukai.
This is the West Lake, madam. The driver stopped. Yoriko got off. If you continue on this road, you can go along the lake all the way to the other side. But as you see, it's too narrow for a car, and it's in pretty bad shape. Yoriko kept the car waiting there and walked the way the driver told her. It was quiet. She stood there looking at the lake. The opposite side was brown lava. On top of it, the Sea of Trees, which spread endlessly towards the bottom, like an ocean.
We sent Studio 360's Pike Malinowski to check out this forest with its dark, dark reputation.
I traveled in Yuriko's footsteps out to Mount Fuji.
The first view of the mountain is like a blow to your stomach. Towering Godzilla-like over everything, it's perfect. Like a child's drawing. Yamada Yoshifumi was born here 83 years ago.
He says,
that's the voice of Chie, my translator.
I have been looking at Mount Fuji ever since I was born.
I run into him as he's taking pictures of Fuji with a huge telephoto lens.
It's always the same, but the clouds changes and the colors, and so it's very, very beautiful, even though I've been looking at it all my life.
Yamada is a volunteer firefighter, and he's taken out many bodies from the forest. He remembers one story in particular.
There was a college professor who fell in love with a waitress of a cafe, and the parents of the college professor was against his love. So they came to Aokigahara Jukai trying to commit suicide.
I'm confused. This story sounds a lot like the 1960s novel that has taken a lot of blame for the suicides. But Yamada says this is a true story.
The woman took the sleeping pills and she died. But the professor, even though he took the sleeping pill, he didn't die right away. And he got out of the forest. But he didn't want other people to find him because he was ashamed. So he wore his shoes the other way so that people thought that he was walking the other direction. But right around the city hall, he died there.
Turns out the history of suicides go further back than that novel. Also, up until the 19th century, Upasuteyama was practiced here, where locals would carry the old people into the forest and leave them there to die, to save food. Some say their ghosts still haunt the forest.
I'm going for a walk in the forest today. Does he have any advice for me?
He says not to go inside of the Jukai. You can take the footpath, but don't go inside of the forest, or you may get lost.
Yuriko pulled out a little bottle from her handbag. She poured it over her hand. White pills accumulated. They made tiny noises. Yuriko drank water. Then, slowly, dividing them in three, she put the pills in her mouth. She drank water again. She climbed up the slope. On one side was the lake. On the other, the sea of trees.
So we're going off the road now and into the forest, which is really, really quite dark.
Should make sure we can find our way back out again.
Ah, yeah.
Tom O'Brien, an Irish architect who's been living and working by the forest for a month, has agreed to walk along.
Yeah, there are all these little holes in the ground.
I can see what you meant earlier about the forest kind of leading you in certain directions just because it's easier to walk certain ways.
As we enter the forest, we see a big wooden sign. Your life is a precious gift from your parents. Think about them and the rest of your family. You don't have to suffer alone. Call us. And then a phone number, 555-220110.
Wow. What did you find?
A cassette. It's probably somebody's mixtape. The rest is in our imagination. Dire Straits, 1988.
Really?
No.
So it's just a mixtape?
It's just a blank cassette. There's nothing written on it. It could be nothing on it.
Telling bad jokes is our self-defense against the gloominess. We walk for another couple of hours until the sun starts to set. The eeriest thing about this forest is the silence.
Wow, it's so quiet.
Yeah. It's really incredible. Quiet. Yeah.
There's not a single bird.
No.
And there's no wind.
What you can hear is the leaves falling.
Right.
Just, you know, hear kind of a little crackling.
And then, of course, the body count. 59 in 2001, 78 in 2002, and 100 in 2003. In recent years, local government has stopped publicizing the annual suicide count. They try to downplay the whole thing to avoid giving people good ideas. And because suicide tourism has become a morbid activity, kids go into the forest at night to look for bodies and spook each other out. Just search for Aokigahara on YouTube and you'll see plenty of evidence.
It's getting dark now. We're heading back. Tom, you know your way.
Yes. A really confident yes. I've a fair idea. I think we're okay.
It's pitch black and freezing when we get back to the Solar Cafe, a little hostel right at the edge of the forest. It's a wholesome place, connected to a small organic farm with a couple of sheep. But the cafe is also one of the last outposts people pass on their way into the forest.
A lot of times I see people walking down the road in front of the cafe. And
Jacob Rayner bought this old truck stop some years ago and has turned it into a little hippie haven.
When you see somebody wearing all black and kind of dragging their bag along, you get a little bit worried. And we usually, you know, do rock, scissors, papers to see who has to go out and talk to them and try and get him in for a cup of coffee or something.
Over the years, he's managed to stop quite a few people from committing suicide in the forest.
The couple people that I've caught on the way in were young guys. One guy I found sleeping in the bushes near my cafe one night, and I said, "What are you doing out here?" And he's like, "Oh, I'm just hiking around." And I said, "Are you going back to Tokyo tomorrow?" And he didn't have any plans, and he obviously had come with no money and no plans of going back. He was a recent college graduate, and he'd been out of school for 8 months and hadn't found a job yet. And in Japan, traditionally, that's just the most horrible thing. You usually have a job lined up, and he had nothing lined up and was feeling really depressed and was afraid to face his parents and let his family down. And I think that's why he'd come out.
Shame, guilt, money problems. There are many different reasons for the high Japanese suicide rate. But it seems to me they all have one thing in common. A lack of ability to change or to cope with change. On the last day of my trip, I asked my translator about this. Chie Yoshimune is a middle-aged woman from Tokyo who's rented a house out here to get more space and peace of mind.
I think in America, like, they can move and they can leave their past behind because the country is so big and there are lots of people and there are various values. So you can easily switch your places and change your lifestyle or whatever. You can go to somewhere where people don't know you. But in Japan, we are kind of a community oriented. Tokyo is a big city, but there aren't many other places where you can go and start a new life. So it's very difficult for, I think, Japanese people to escape.
Yuriko's feet were still quite stable, no change in her mind. An old man and his daughter, working by the side of the road, noticed this city-looking woman walking towards the forest. "Excuse me." The old man signaled the unfamiliar woman. "That's the wrong way. It doesn't go anywhere." She stopped. "You have to go back to the fork. Then you go straight and find the road where the bus passes." She looked like someone from Tokyo to him. She bowed, seemed like she appreciated the warning. "Once you go over that road, you can never come back." The two continued working in the fields. Then the daughter looked up. "Hey," she said. The voice raised the old man's head too. "The lady. She just ran into the forest."
¶¶
Those passages of Seicho Matsumoto's novel were read by Eliza Foss. You can also see some pictures from Pike's journey through the forest at studio360.org. On next week's show, we'll have lots more stories from our trip to Japan. We'll meet young women artists who are taking the art world there by storm. And I will totally geek out in a toy store for grown-ups.
Well, if you look over there, you can see all the varieties of wigs.
This is awesome. But, yeah, I mean, there are no teenage girls or little girls in here. It's all, like, middle-aged guys buying this stuff.
And that is it for our show this week. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll join us again for next week's show. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Lital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Pike Malinowski,
Sarah Lilly,
Rob Weisberg,
Eric Malinsky,
Damon Whittemore,
Catherine Epstein,
Kurt Schlachter,
Josie Holtzman,
Nick Haling.
Special thanks this week to Eliza Foss, Ken Marks, Richard Milgram, David DeHealy, and Shizu Yuasa. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegen.
PRI's Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, by the Lilly Auchincloss Foundation, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Studio 360 in Japan is supported in part by the Freeman Foundation and the United States Japan Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360.
There's the camera, and this one says, be a beautiful girl. Do you want to be a beautiful girl?
I do. I've always wanted to be a beautiful girl.
Okay.
We burrow deep into contemporary Japan.
I'm excited.
A Japanese makeover for me. Next time in
Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson
from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.